Today's reading is from Luke. In the days of King Herod of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly order of Abia. His wife was a descendant of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. Both of them were righteous before God, living blamelessly according to all the commandments and regulations of the Lord. But they had no children because Elizabeth was barren and both were getting on in years. Once, when he was serving as priest before God, his section was on duty. He was chosen by lot, according to the customs of priesthood, to enter the sanctuary of the Lord and offer incense. Now, at the time of the incense offering, the whole assembly of the people was praying outside. Then there appeared to him an angel of the Lord, standing on the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was terrified, and fear overwhelmed him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you will name him John." The word of God for the people of God.
Silence is awkward when you expect someone to speak. How uncomfortable did you feel? Something must be wrong. Why isn't he talking? And ours lasted about 20 seconds. Imagine 400 years. That's how long the intertestamental period was, the period between what we call the Old Testament and the New Testament, a period which is described this way, when there was no word from the Lord. When Luke writes his gospel, he begins a period of history in which the people have spent 400 years waiting, wondering, what is wrong? Why is God not speaking? And when the word is spoken, Luke begins the birth story of Jesus, not in Bethlehem, but some distance away, in Jerusalem, focusing on an individual who, as much as any, personifies that awkward silence. A person who appears in no manger scene, who adorns no Christmas card. An old priest named Zechariah, who was serving his duty in the temple. If you haven't done so already, I invite you to take out your outline for the message. As we focus this morning on this person named Zechariah, who for Luke is where the Christmas story begins and for us continues. Right off the bat, we know a couple of things that are very important about Zechariah and his wife Elizabeth. We first of all know that they are blameless. They're upright, they are devout in carrying out their duties before God. Luke says they're blameless, an important word. It means that if any misfortune comes into their lives, it's not going to be by their doing. They've done nothing to displease God. They are the opposite of the people of Isaiah's day, we talked about last week, who had no one to blame for their problems except themselves. They couldn't point a finger at others. They were to blame for the troubles that they were having. But this week, Zechariah and Elizabeth, the Bible says they're blameless. They've done nothing wrong to bring misfortune into their lives. And yet, the very next thing we know about them is that they are barren. They are barren. Now, why was that important to mention? Well, there were three important things about having children in that day and time, first of all, it represented that you've been blessed by God to be able to have children. Second of all, it means you're faithful in carrying out your covenant responsibility to produce a future generation of God's people. And thirdly, it means that in your old age, you're going to have someone to take care of you. You see, in that day and time, children were your 401k plan. But to be barren, that represents a curse from God. New Testament scholar Alan Culpepper says this: barrenness was regarded as a tragedy, a disgrace, and even a sign of God's punishment. So these blameless people are having to live with the public disgrace that they obviously have done something in their lives to bring upon them this curse from God. We don't know what it is, but I know people speculate. There are their whispers. Zechariah probably did this. Elizabeth probably did that. Why else? Why else would they have this curse from God? So here are these faithful people who bring a deep longing in their lives. What is yours? As we go through the message, there are a couple of places I'm going to offer some reflection questions that'll be just a good way to continue the thought of this morning's sermon. And if you're in a small group that carries on these conversations, that's just a great way to connect with other people. These will be helpful questions for you. So the first reflection question is this: what am I longing for this Christmas? What am I longing for this Christmas? What is the longing of your heart that you bring to this Advent season and this soon-to-be Christmas celebration? What are you praying for? What is an emptiness in your life? What is something that if God were to show up and provide you, you would say, that's an answer to my prayer? Well, the day that we meet Zechariah happens to be the day he got the answer to his prayer. It was a once-in-a-lifetime day, literally. His division was on duty at the temple, and he was the one to go in and perform the priestly function. Now, in that day and time, there were about 20,000 priests in Israel. They were divided into different divisions, so each division had 2 weeks a year, 14 days to perform the twice daily function in the temple, to go in and put the oil in the lamp and to do several other matters. And only one priest could do it, and it was very important. So you can do the math and figure out that not every priest got to perform this function. In fact, you were chosen by lot. Literally, your name on a piece of paper that would be pulled out and read, and once your name was read, it was removed from the lot forevermore. In other words, you got to do it once in your lifetime, and most priests never even got that chance. But if your name got chosen, it was once in a lifetime. Well, it was once in a lifetime for more reasons than that for Zechariah, because when he goes into the holy room, as he's performing the functions, what happens? He encounters the angel Gabriel, who speaks and says, "Be not afraid, your prayer has been heard." Isaiah was scared to death. Who wouldn't be? Who would not be by some celestial experience in life? Even the most irreligious person in life would have to be scared to death by the sight of an angel. How much more so for Zechariah? The angel says, "You're going to have a son." Zechariah can't believe this. He says, "How can that be so?" You see, he and his wife had gotten too old to have a child. Their day has passed. The chance of their prayer being answered, that's over. No wonder he was scared. He had been showing up, carrying out his religious responsibility every day, but along the way, lost the expectation that God actually hears him. There's a story about a little girl who learned about a missionary supported by her church. She came home and told her parents, "I want to write the missionary a letter." Her parents said, "That's a wonderful idea, but don't expect a response. You know, missionaries are busy people." So the little girl wrote her letter. Dear Mr. Missionary, I'm writing to let you know we are praying for you, but we aren't expecting an answer. Honest. Have you ever prayed that way? Have you ever said, God, I'm throwing this prayer up, but honestly, I'm not expecting an answer. I come in here every week. I come to church. I go about my faithful duties and responsibilities. I try to be a good person. I've kind of given up that you're really going to meet this longing in my life. I'm not looking for an answer. What do you do when your faith gets to that point? What do you do when you find yourself just going through the routines of being a faithful person, but you really aren't expecting God to show up? Let's consider what Zechariah did. Consider what Zechariah did. First of all, one thing you observe about his life is he remained faithful. He remained faithful. This is how he is described at the start by the Gospel of Luke. He was serving as priest before God. He still showed up. He still carried out his duty. And maybe you would say that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. He doesn't believe anymore, or at least he's not expecting God to show up, and yet he's being faithful? I don't really understand how that can happen. And yet, look what happened. Because he continued to show up even after losing hope that God was going to change his situation, one day he discovered God showed up and God changed his situation. God took that which he had no power over anymore and did what only God can do. In fact, that's another helpful place for reflection. What can I do that might allow me to experience what only God can do? What can I do that might allow me to experience what only God can do? Continue coming to worship? Continue serving in my ministry? Continue being in my small group? Continue praying? Continuing to do my devotions? Even when I don't feel like it? Even when I'm not sure I even believe it anymore? Even when I'm not feeling faithful? Yes, because you never know. You never know when that day comes, when God shows up and does what only God can do. In order for faith to sustain, at some point, faith has to depend on more than feelings. That day will come for everyone. At some point in the life of faith, faith, in order to sustain, has to depend on more than feelings. It comes down to showing up and being present and just opening ourselves for what God can do. Pastor Javon and I were talking about this point this past week. He says, you know, the hardest thing in ministry, I think, is when there are people who don't like you and you still have to minister to them. People who get disappointed by you, people who get mad about some decision you make, and you've still got to show up because they're looking at you on Sunday morning and you got to preach to them. And they get sick and you got to go visit them. I think that's the hardest. And when he was talking about this, I went back 20 years ago to a church that went through a painful experience. We dismissed a very popular staff person. And really, to protect that person, we did not get up and tell the congregation why. And of course, people did not understand. And there was one fellow about my age who was really angry. The only reason he didn't leave the church is because his wife sang in our praise team. So he would be there for her. And one Sunday, right before Christmas, she was rehearsing on an early Sunday morning before anybody else got there. He was sitting in the back of the church. So as I walked by him, I thought, I cannot let his anger toward me change my willingness to at least show consideration. I went over and I said, good morning. He looked at me and I'll promise you, he growled and said, don't you ever speak to me. And in that moment, I thought he was angry enough to take a swing at me. So I honored his request. I did not speak to him again for 5 years. He would be there every Sunday, glaring at me as I preached, walking past me and turning his head the other way. 5 years after that event, I took a sabbatical. It had been a hard 5 years. There were days I literally had the phone in my hand about to dial the bishop's office in Charlotte and say, I cry, uncle, move me. I'm ready to go. I feel like I've had a good ministry here, but it's just gotten too hard. Get me out of here. And something would keep me from doing it, and I'd hang up the phone. 5 years later, getting ready for sabbatical, he calls the office and invites me to lunch. I go and I meet him. He said, 5 years ago, I was so angry with you because I did not understand. I have come to learn some things since that time, and now I realize I'm wrong, and I know you're going on a sabbatical because of people like me. And I can't erase the last 5 years, but I can tell you I'm so sorry. You know what I felt like in that moment? The last 5 years were worth that moment. They were worth hearing that, to show up every day, as hard as it might be, to not always have the feeling in your gut that I love being here today, but to be there and to do it because you have to do it in order one day to experience God doing what was beyond my power to do. God showing up to do what only God could do. Now, there's something else to learn from Zechariah. And it's not just that he remained faithful, but he came to a point where he discovered how his longings fit within the longings of God. How his longings fit within the longings of God. He heard from the angel Gabriel, your prayer's been answered and you're going to have a son. But listen to what the angel goes on to say about that son. He will be a joy and delight to you, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord. In other words, this son is not just about your happiness, Zechariah. This son has something to do that's bigger than you. This son has something to do with God's purposes. Zechariah would learn his longings fit within the longings of God. You only have to fast forward a little bit to understand how this plays out. This answer to Zechariah and Elizabeth's prayer would grow up to be John the Baptist, who led the great spiritual awakening of Israel to prepare for the coming of the Christ. His role was significant, but because of his ministry, he was imprisoned by Herod and beheaded. Now just think about that. Had Zechariah and Elizabeth lived long enough to bury their son, how do you think they felt? All of those years of waiting for a child, and then they get the joy of having their prayer answered, only to one day have to bury him. It's very clear that this son was not just for their happiness, but he played a critical role in God's purpose. Zechariah and Elizabeth would learn that all of their longings, all of their joy, all of their grief is bound up together as something that God can use and God can put to work. How do your longings fit within the longings of God? If you were to say, God, this is what I want from you this Christmas, my guess is you probably have a pretty quick list you could pull out for what God wants you to do. But this is where Jesus separates from Santa Claus. Santa Claus is that magical figure who can give you whatever you wish for. Who doesn't love Santa? Jesus has the power to do the same, except for this. Jesus knows that getting everything you want in life doesn't always lead to your happiness. Remember the movie Bruce Almighty? Bruce is this average, ordinary guy who isn't all that religious, but he is mad with God. He's mad that God isn't answering his prayers and making life easier for him so that he can be more successful. And one day, God shows up in his life and scares him just like Zechariah. God says, "You think you can do better? Have at it. You get to be God for a while." And at first, it's fun. He uses all of his power for himself and to make his life easier. The trouble comes when he has to start dealing with other people's prayers. And he can't handle it. It's too much. So he just starts answering everybody, "Yes. Whatever you want, yes. You get it." And at first, that appears to be nice. You overhear some people saying, "All of my stock investments have gone up." A woman says, "I lost 40 pounds on the Krispy Kreme diet." I mean, getting what you want in life seems great, but then you learn other things. Everybody won the lottery, and it caused a financial crisis. The people who were praying for great weather here caused a tsunami over here. And before long, the whole world is in chaos. This secular comedy packs a profound theological punch that says getting everything you want doesn't really lead to happiness. So here's another helpful question. If God answered all your prayers, would the world look different or just your life? If God answered all your prayers, would the world look any different or just your life? When you pray, "Lord, heal me, give me good health," do you continue that prayer and say, "So that I can continue to serve you and help other people as you would through my life?" When you pray, "Lord, protect me, keep my family safe," do you continue the prayer and say, "So that I can advocate on behalf of those in our society whose lives are most at risk?" When you say, "Lord, give me financial prosperity, help my house to sell," do you go on to say, "So that I can be even more generous to you? I stepped on my own toes that time." If all of your prayers were answered, would the world look any different? Or just your life? One last lesson I think we can take from Zechariah. Zechariah learned to believe again. He learned to believe again. So he was told by the angel when he did not believe that his prayer was answered, when he said the question, "How can this be?" The angel said, "From this day forward, you're not going to be able to hear or speak until the day that this promise is fulfilled and your child is born." And so he goes for 9 months. He can't say anything, he can't hear anything. But then the day that the child is born and afterward they bring him to the temple for dedication, his tongue is loosened and he says, "Blessed be the God of Israel." Now think about that. The last word spoken, how can this be? The first word spoken after 9 months, "Blessed be God." What do you think happened in those 9 months? I mean, Zechariah couldn't have gone back to work. How do you bless people if you can't speak? He couldn't even hear what they're saying. I imagine Zechariah just moping around the house every day, doing nothing but watch his wife, old enough to be a grandmother, starting to show a baby bump. And then the bump got bigger and bigger and bigger. And one day the child is born. And he proclaims, "Blessed be the God of Israel." There are some experiences of God that come only through silence. Long, awkward, sometimes painful silence. But there are experiences of God that come no other way. George Shaw's play about Joan of Arc pictures this scene with her standing before the heir to the throne of France. He's frustrated with Joan of Arc because she keeps claiming to hear voices from God. He finally slams his hand down and says, "Oh, your voices, your voices. Why don't I hear the voices? I'm the king after all." Listen to her response. "They do come to you, but you don't hear them. When the bells ring at the end of worship, you cross yourself and you're done with it. But if you prayed from your heart and listened to the thrilling of the bells in the air after they stopped ringing, you would hear the voices as well as I do." There are some experiences of God that come only through silence. Only through tuning out the distractions of the world, only in covering our mouth and hushing our own anxiety and doing nothing but observing what God is doing. In fact, I want to invite you to try that as a Zechariah experiment for yourself this week. Try it just for 1 week. You don't even have to do 9 months, but that week might want you to do it for 9 months. I want you to challenge yourself to tune out distractions this week. Listen to the news less. Just give your newspaper to somebody else in the neighborhood in the morning. Don't read it. Tune some things out. And don't speak your anxiety. Don't speak your words. "I don't know how this is going to turn. I don't know how we're going to make it." Just watch. And any little thing that looks like God doing something, make a note about it. It doesn't have to be grand. Anything that looks like, I could see God in that. I felt God's presence. Maybe it's in the sunrise of the morning or the twinkling stars at night. Just make a log. Keep a journal. And at the end of the week, read it and see what it does. I knew a woman in a church one time. She had a strange New Year's tradition. She kept a prayer journal throughout the year. She would write down whatever it was she was praying for, every request, and whenever something was answered, she'd come back and highlight it in red. Whether it was answered the way she was praying for or not, even if the answer was no, but it was clear, God answered, highlight in red. Here's what she did on New Year's Day. She would take her journal, sit in front of her, and then she would thumb through the pages. And she said, what I do is I enjoy how much red is in my journal. And when I begin the year seeing red, I start my year full of faith that God is at work. God is present. Try your experiment this week. Try being still. Try observing. And see how God shows up. This Sunday, I don't ask you to go forth and do anything. I don't ask you to go forth and say a whole lot. I simply ask you, be still.